many health systems are now involved in COVID vaccine communication efforts. I haven't heard any health system in the United States doing this, but there is a bakery in Germany that's cooking up, as the title says in this article, syringe-shaped cakes to promote COVID-19 vaccines.
You know what will push people over the edge is all those people that aren't quite sure. Let's just give them baked goods. I mean, do we start making cakes in the shape of other things we want them to do? Is this just for all vaccines? Because, I mean, now it's like I've got to determine by looking at the cake what kind of shot it is. Do I get two cakes? Do I get a second one in 28 days or whatever?
Welcome to Touchpoint, a podcast dedicated to discussions on digital marketing and patient engagement strategies for hospitals, health systems, and physician practices. In this podcast, we'll dive deep into digital tools, solutions, and strategies that are impacting our industry today. We hope to share a lot of great information with you and have fun along the way. Thanks for joining us. Now, here are your hosts.
All right, welcome to episode number 207 of Touchpoint. I am Reed Smith. That is Chris Boyer.
Hey, Reed, how's it going? I'm eating baked goods over here in preparation for my vaccines coming up.
Well, there you go. That sounds great. Well, thanks everybody for joining us. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for coming back. If you're a repeat listener, if you're new to the show, welcome. Quick plug for the website, touchpoint.health. Of course, you can find us on all the major podcast platforms and even streaming ones, Spotify, if you like to do that kind of thing. Be sure to check us out. Also, if you go to the website, check out the TPS report. It's a weekly email that comes out, has five or six links in it to stories aggregated by all the show hosts on the network. It's a quick read, comes to your inbox every Monday morning. We encourage you to sign up for that. Also, while you're there at the website, you'll notice, boy, there's sure a lot of shows and episodes here. So check out some of the other ones. It's not just Touchpoint the show. We've got all kinds of, probably upper teens, maybe 20 other shows on the network now. I kind of lose track. So anyway, check them out. There's some really great ones there, different topics, different show hosts. We'll pause here, let you go do that, and be back with today's episode. Chris, in today's digital age, your online reputation, as we all know, is crucial. With customers relying on online reviews, your first impression is also compared directly with your competitors.
Sure is. And Reed, consider this. 86% of patients today read online reviews, and 73% demand that that healthcare provider has a minimum 4-star rating.
Demand. They demand it.
Yeah, they do.
Well, to stand out, choose reputation to help amplify your brand and to build trust. Be the provider of choice in your area, understand patient sentiment, get actionable insights, and even foster patient loyalty.
And look, here's the easy way you could do that. All you need to do is go visit reputation.com/touchpoint. That's reputation.com/touchpoint, where you can download their healthcare online reputation management guide and build a reputation that performs for you.
So today we're going to hit on a topic that I think, you know, we've talked about this historically, and certainly we've talked about topics that would include this as an action, but the idea of thought leadership.
Mm-hmm.
We at Girard do an awful lot of this. You'll get to hear from our editorial manager, David Schifrin, later in the show about kind of how he thinks about thought leadership and practically how he executes it and some of those types of things. So some cool takeaways and even tips and very tactical things there. But the idea of thought leadership and really what does that mean for us in this day and age as we think about trust, willingness to return, and all the things that we've, you know, talked about on some of the surveys and things that we've pulled in the show over the last 6 to 9 months or so.
Thought leadership is one great way to take that trust and utilize that relationship that you have with your different audiences in order to convey ideas or help them sway some action in certain ways or whatever it would be. And it does certainly reinforce your brand. So what you're talking about, thought leadership, is just starting a blog, right, Reed? Isn't that all we need to do?
That's all it is. Go get a blogger account and just take off. No, so this kind of came back around because I saw NRC's Health Consumer Trends Survey come out for 2021. And started kind of looking through it. A lot of it resonated. A lot of it sounded like some of the things that we had surfaced at Girard with some of the studies that we've done. And so it was kind of this idea that there's still something here around trust, and thought leadership plays such a role in that. It just seemed to make sense to, you know, kind of dive back into this, resurface this a little bit as we start kind of a new calendar year.
Yeah, I think you summed up this NRC study pretty well, where you said the good news is that no one has brand loyalty, but that's also the bad news.
Right. Yeah, there is no brand loyalty. And again, they pull out some different things in the study, and we're going to kind of jump in and start going through that. But one kind of overarching theme here, whether it's the NRC piece, whether it's the studies we did at Girard, the healthcare providers, especially doctors and nurses, mm-hmm. you know, they're the ones that have still garnered the most trust. People already trusted them. But what we're seeing through the pandemic and over almost the last 12 months now, I guess you would say, that trust has only heightened, only gone up. Then it becomes like, okay, well, that's awesome. But okay, now what? There is a certain amount of responsibility there, certainly, in the way that we push and prod and drive the conversation and some of those types of things. And so maybe let's jump in and start looking at the NRC findings. And I think some of this will start to make sense.
Yeah, it's a real interesting survey that you shared, Reed, and we'll put the link in the show notes for people listening in, and definitely encourage you to go download that. They kind of categorize some of their findings into four major areas, and we'll start kind of breaking down each one in point. The first is, they said, came right out of the gate with the big one, there's no particular preference for a healthcare brand. And they supplemented that by saying that in the wake of COVID-19, 45% of consumers report that they have already changed their healthcare brand preference. Over the last year, 45% have changed their healthcare brand.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing, right?
That's a lot of people. And in addition, they say 62% expect their brand preferences to change once the pandemic has ended. So, I mean, we have a very loose marketplace when it comes to brand loyalty.
This is kind of the big theme of part one of this study around brand preference. And then we'll also get into, you know, the other three pieces that you mentioned, care deferment, telehealth, and digital innovations, which we'll camp out with for just a little bit. But if you think about that, I mean, that's half. I mean, half the folks, you know, have already changed their mind. They say if you go back and you look at the 36% of consumers who express no particular brand preference, which again, I think this is the opportunity as well as kind of the downside, 21% of those say they seek care based solely on recommendations of their primary care physicians, which probably makes sense. That wasn't terribly shocking to me. 16% say that they seek care based on proximity. So that's a lot of just what's the closest thing to me kind of a deal. Again, not terribly surprising. And 22% say they simply do not know enough about the local health systems to make an informed choice. That's interesting. And I think, again, an opportunity there. So if you think about this, it's about referral patterns. It's about geography. And then quite honestly, there's a certain amount that, you know, I wonder how many of those just haven't had an introduction to the healthcare system. You know, they're younger, they're probably healthy, you know, that kind of thing. But in any case, inside this big, I guess, bulk of brand perception, consumers still trust doctors and healthcare staff.
That's the overriding theme here, right? Consumers trust doctors and healthcare staff. And healthcare staff, by the way, is interesting because as we look into vaccine rollouts, and we're going to start to see maybe not just doctors being responsible for the vaccines, right? We're going to start to see their pharmacists, people that actually work in Walgreens and CVS and other of those retail organizations. So I think they kind of extend that trust to those types of people that are meeting with them face to face. You know, what's interesting here too is that our additional data point that comes out of here, it says few healthcare consumers express trust in healthcare services from brands like Walmart, Amazon, or Google, though. That's an interesting takeaway as well, because it's now not a rush towards the big tech companies, which we know that they're kind of eating away at our marketplace, so to speak. It's still that trust resides with that local healthcare provider, those people that they actually have that relationship with. The second point they talk about is healthcare deferment. And we'll talk a little bit about this because there may be some rationale around why the deferment occurs that is related to trust. But they do say here that only 22.4% of patients deferred care in the first quarter of 2020. But then that number jumped to 30.4% in Q2. And we expect that trajectory to continue to increase. And obviously, that's related to COVID. People are delaying care because they don't want to expose themselves unnecessarily.
They said that 40% of those that delayed care mentioned the disease specifically, while 17.2% said they were willing to manage on their own. You could argue the need of care potentially there. But then 16% said they were unable to afford the cost of services. So again, if you look at some of the Girard stuff that we pulled out earlier in the year, there were an awful lot of people that were affected via COVID on the insurance side of the equation, like they lost insurance, they lost their job, you know, those types of things. And so I'm sure we'll see a ripple effect around, you know, the ability to afford these services. So it's going to take a little while, I think, for some of that to rebound based on somebody getting a new job or new insurance and just kind of that whole ramp up period. Even pretty well paying jobs, sometimes it's, you know, kind of a 90-day window before your benefits kick in, you know, or something like that, right? So there's a chance that it takes a little bit for all that to come back.
That's always going to be there in terms of the affordability of care. I think that that's being highlighted by this study and by COVID in particular. One other point, people age 75 or plus, 68% of them said COVID concerns drove their care delays. Whereas the millennials, the largest majority, 21.3%, delayed because they thought care wasn't that prevalent to them. You know, as we look at how do we engage and build relationships and build momentum around the trust that we have with our various consumers and patients in our marketplace, we probably also have to think about this segmented by age and demographic.
And I wonder how much of that is like preventative or wellness-based stuff that's being put off. Again, going back to thought leadership, going back to the trust of the physicians, you know, that's I think is an opportunity certainly for a lot of folks to promote what the opportunity is and that you still need to be taken care in a preventative way. The next section of the report is, and again, much like the healthcare deferment piece, we're not going to spend a ton of time here, but they talk about telehealth. And we've talked a lot about telehealth over the recent months. Obviously, it's time to shine. You know, people were kind of forced into this model. You could probably make the same comments about Slack or Microsoft Teams or Zoom, right? It was always good and always something that, you know, people found value in. But when you force the masses into something like that, you really get to understand what the opportunity is and the feedback is.
We've had people on before that have indicated that this virtual health setting is an underutilized touch point where we could engage people that are connecting with us in different ways, through digital ways. And when we look at thought leadership and trust, I think that's reflected in these digital experiences that they have with telehealth. I actually had my first telehealth meeting with my doctor. I thought the experience was great, and it kind of underlines some of the findings here in the study. 92% like positive sentiment about the telehealth visit. I felt the same way. It was convenient. 85% believe their provider was attentive and listening. Yeah, because we had a one-on-one dialogue. 60% said that making a telehealth connection was easy. Yeah, that's true. The one underscoring thing here, though, is, and I'm not sure if it's similar, but it probably will be something of concern, is I then got the bill later on in the week, and we are out of the CARES Act, so they're no longer reimbursing video visits at the same rate they were in the previous year. So that was a bit of a sticker shock for me.
Yeah, and that was, you know, they call out what some of the detractors criticized, and that was one, you know, about concerns about insurance or fees, you know, that kind of thing. I think some people felt a lack of empathy or they say emotional support, you know, compared to in-person visits, which, yeah, okay. I mean, certainly as a whole, I'm sure there are people that do it very, very well, but it's hard, obviously, virtually to convey certain emotions. Some observed a decline in professionalism. There were some technological or equipment issues, which I can only imagine But that's part of it. We can't roll out some big technology advancement and not expect some help desk calls.
I still have problems with my computer and my phone, but that doesn't mean I throw them out as tools. I use them very extensively. It's just part of the nature of being digital, right? Again, this is an underutilized engagement touch point, and one that we probably want to consider as part of our thought leadership strategies moving forward. There's also one other major finding that the NRC study found that we want to dig into, but why don't we pause here for just a moment, and then we'll come back and we'll dig into this one in specific, and then kind of turn our attentions towards thought leadership, which will lead to this great interview that we have later on in the show. We'll do that right after this break.
Coming soon from Greystone, Bowstring, and Touchpoint Media, live from HCIC, a new podcast that brings you front row access to the latest innovative strategies that are shaping tomorrow's healthcare industry. In this 12-part series, as recorded live at the Healthcare Internet Conference, we'll hear from industry experts such as Paul Mattson of the Cleveland Clinic, Kathy Smith of Roper St. Francis Healthcare, David Feinberg from Mount Sinai Health System, Rose Glenn from Michigan Medicine, and many others. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or your favorite podcasting platform. This podcast series is brought to you by Greystone.net, Bowstring, and Touchpoint Media.
All right, the fourth and final point to the NRC study is digital innovation. And this is really where, you know, we've kind of been leading this whole time through this document, is the idea that digital innovation has an opportunity. It's an opportunity not just for us, but for providers. And, you know, lo and behold, people like it, you know, like the telehealth piece. So this is separate from telehealth. And they really kind of break it out even into a couple of sections in here, wearables. And then, you know, secondarily, we'll talk a little bit about social media. Looking at wearables, if they say that 36% of healthcare consumers currently own a wearable health device, or they use their smartphone to track wellness. I'm trying to decide if I think that's high or low.
I know that I fall into that category, so I'm part of that 36%. I agree. I think that number, I would expect it to be a little bit higher, but I think there are just that great number of people in our country right now that are just not that actively involved with managing and tracking their health.
I guess it's 36% actually do it. If you just said, well, how many people own an Apple Watch? You know, the number's probably higher.
Yeah, I agree. That makes
sense. They also have about 50% of them would trust the information gathered by the devices to be relayed directly from the device to their doctor's office. So we got 36% of the people actually doing things, in which case half those folks would say, I'm good with this little thing transmitting information directly to my physician on my behalf.
They actually called out the word trust, right? So here again is an opportunity where there may not be a high trust in like the Amazon or the Google, which now owns Fitbit, or Apple for that matter. There might not be a lot of trust in those organizations per se, but they do trust that information being shared with their doctor. And again, their doctor taking action with that data. In fact, they go on to say that 57% believe that data would be useful in conversations with their healthcare providers and would want it to be collected if they're ever in the need of a healthcare service. I think that kind of reinforces the fact that those people that are tracking their health, be it they're the younger worried well, so to speak, right? Or the older people dealing with chronic conditions, those are the people that see the value and want to use that data in a very actionable way. And again, leverage is an opportunity for us as healthcare providers to start having good conversations around the use of these tools in thought leadership.
Well, let's look at and I think this is the one that we can spend a few minutes on. The second underutilized digital channel, as they call it, is social media. There's no shortage of metrics around this. You can Google and find any level of data you want relative to social media, right? Any sort of metrics, all that kind of stuff. They say the rate of internet users actively seeking health information on social media is low. Around 23%, they say, and that number is likely to rise. I would think it's higher than that.
I would stress the word actively seeking health information. I think usage of social media is much higher than that, but people digging into Facebook and other platforms to seek out information actively, maybe that's why that number comes in just below a quarter. I would agree with you though, Reed, that seems a little bit low to me.
They say that 70% of healthcare consumers expressed an interest in getting at least some healthcare information through social media. That's good, I guess.
Yeah, I guess the devil's in the details on that one. I think a fair number, right? It's over two-thirds, they're saying here, want to get some healthcare information through social media. But as we look at that, and we know that social media has been plagued with misinformation, and that's probably why active searchers for health information is pretty low. That might play into that. I wonder if those two numbers deliberately or causally different than the other, right? 23% actively use it, but 70% say they want information that way. What are your thoughts on that?
This is a weird one because getting information, like getting it from where? And I think this gets us back to the thought leadership angle and, you know, the trust of that information. Social media is a weird one to me. I don't know that I want any advice or information through social media.
We're jaded. And I think we're recording this like in the middle of January of 2021, where we've already had this massive societal shifts in their view of social media too, Reed. That might be playing into this a little bit. But yeah, I agree with you too. I don't go to Facebook or Twitter to get healthcare information. Well, I guess I would say personal healthcare information. I do go to those channels though to get information about the industry. So maybe I am in that 70%.
I mean, I technically do, I guess, get it through social media.
Even you and I are doing something that's a little bit social right now. So Right. Maybe we're, it's just an interesting take. But the third takeaway is the one that really gives us a unique opportunity. And this one surprised me.
62% of consumers say that they trust the information they get from social media as long as it comes directly from a healthcare provider. So I gave the little pause there because when I first was reading through this, I thought, oh my gosh, we're doomed. But I think that's interesting, right? So long as it comes directly from a healthcare provider. And these are things that we've seen, right? Relative to trust and all that stuff. That's who they want to hear from. There's the Girard study again. You know, all that was up at the top. We're like even local media, national media, elected officials, all that stuff was all down at the bottom of the list. I mean, I like that opportunity for us.
I think it's a great opportunity. But again, it comes down to how does that work? I think the devil's in the details here. Again, you refer to channels as like a potential question that needs to be addressed. I think also the type of content. I also think about, you know, different ways that you can express that content and how do we leverage this trust that we have to effectively use these channels, these social channels in a way that actually can reach through to those consumers in a relevant way. Before we go to the interview, why don't we drill into this other article that we found from Forbes that's called How to Be a Thought Leader in the Digital Age.
Well, that's apt. That's exactly what we need to do, right? Yeah, so they talk about for maximum impact and results that thought leaders must use digital to better reach their existing audience, to attract new ones, to influence and create, et cetera. I mean, all the things we think of as it relates to the equity in digital. There's so many examples of so-called experts from every facet of life and business doing digital to boost their brand power, amplify their message, et cetera. You know, you see this on YouTube all the time. And there's a lot of YouTube channels I watch. You know, there are people about like guitars or maybe it's woodworking or whatever. It's really interesting to see them talk, and it's allowed them to create, you know, a livelihood, quite honestly, just being someone that talks in this space.
But one of the things they stress here is that it's more than just talking in the space. It's actually how do you do it in a way that's actually credible and authentic? And I think that's the struggle here. So they outline some very high-level points here. We think that they're very important to kind of cover guidelines on how to start developing a digital thought leadership platform. And the first one, Reed, is consistency. To be successful or effective requires persistence, dedication, and consistency. We know that. And it also involves making sure that you're evaluating every online channel that fits your goals and is aligned with your audiences.
The second one is a clear message. So certainly you got to be consistent, but you've also got to know what you're talking about. You got to have some sort of clarity. So it must be obvious, they say, what you stand for and what you're communicating. You know, you want to be, you know, very much understand the value that you bring to the market, right? And what sets you apart, your goals, et cetera. They talk a lot about digital, the attention span short in digital, and it's extremely crowded in the space. And so you've got to make sure, you know, that you can be heard. You got to have passion. You got to be motivated. You have to be very much bought into the space. The people that do this well, so around clear messaging, are the people that have a very specific and useful viewpoint. You know, they're not doing a little bit of everything.
They're niche. That's kind of like niche content, right? It's very specific and focused. Another point they say here is too, also to leave your ego at the door. Avoid that content that's all about you, which provides no value. The whole point about being a digital thought leader is sharing knowledge, opinions, and insights. It's answering questions, etc. But do it in a way that really is more providing value to your audience rather than providing value to yourself or your organization.
The next one they point out is organic versus paid. And so there's not necessarily the need to spend excessive amounts of money to become a successful thought leader. Certainly that may help you kind of get it in front of some folks and jumpstart things a little bit or whatever. But they say, you know, that the very best thought leaders certainly spend very little to no money on self-promotion. They let what they put out there, you know, kind of do the talking for them, if they will. And certainly the money can help you get there initially, like get the eyeballs initially. But unless you've got really something to say and these other things that we're talking about, like the clarity around message, for example, they're not going to come back. You know, you'll just have kind of a blip in traffic.
Just to wrap up the couple of the other frameworks here, or the other recommendations they have, is honesty and transparency. Lots of people can talk the talk, they say, but what will set you apart is that your results are results that back up the theories that you have. So those people that, you know, talk very high level about trends that are going on in the marketplace, what I think differentiates thought leaders from those people that just, you know, talk is that they actually have tangible results. They're not just talking in hypotheticals. I think it's really important as a thought leader that you're talking about things that you actually know and can demonstrate.
The second and the last one they talk about is delegation. And this is an interesting one. I wouldn't have thought this would have been on the list, but they talk about all this stuff, whether it's writing, making videos, recording a podcast like we're doing now. It's a lot of work. It takes time. You know, I mean, it's not exactly the quickest thing in the world to do, especially back to the very first point, if you want to be consistent. So how do you delegate some of this? And we've had to do this in recent years. I mean, we've got folks now that are editing shows and helping from a project management standpoint and keeping contracts straight with hosts and sponsors and all this stuff, because it just, we can't do all that and do our day jobs and do the show and, you know, all those types of things. So delegation's an interesting one.
I think it's an important one too. And when you're getting into larger health systems, you do have to work together in order to support that, right? So if you have a social media team, leverage on their expertise on how to use those channels and leverage the writers, et cetera. The last point here is branding. I think this makes sense. This is sort of a straightforward point, but I think it's important to reiterate. Make sure your image, your thought leadership platform matches your goals, matches your vision. Make sure all your channels are consistent and reflect your brand. Don't try to position yourself as anything other than what you are. And this gets into the imagery, the video, the written content, the images. All of those things are kind of all part of this. When you talk about your branding, remember that your thought leadership platform is an extension of your brand platform.
All good stuff. All good stuff. Well, let's break here. We've got a great interview. David Schifrin, our editorial manager at Girard. He's got some great thoughts, insights, and even practical tips on thought leadership. So we'll take a brief pause here and then jump into today's interview. And welcome back to the Ask the Expert portion of the podcast. Today, I am joined by my coworker, colleague, David Schifrin. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Reed. Thanks. Nice to have my name follow the word expert. I like that.
That's right. Well, you are. You're not a physician. You're a doctor, however, a PhD. So you're an expert. And more commonly, based on what we're talking about today, you're the one doing the interviewing versus being interviewed, at least in our world, in our place of work, if you will. Jumping in, maybe tell everybody a little bit about your background, kind of what you do here at Girard, and then we'll talk a little bit about thought leadership.
Yeah, so I'm the content marketing manager at Girard. I've been with the firm as of the time of this recording for a little over a year and a half. My role is to really elevate the firm and the ideas within the firm through thought leadership, through content. So blogs, podcasts, videos, social media, whatever that might be. And really kind of try to connect the ideas that are sort of out there in the healthcare media and, you know, that we're hearing from our clients and healthcare providers with sort of the expertise that we've got in-house and try to create a story around all of that. You mentioned, Reed, that I am a doctor. I am. I've got a PhD just to fill out sort of that potential question mark. I've got a PhD in cell biology. And so if you're ever interested in an interesting sort of career development pathway, maybe it's not interesting. I think it's interesting, but you can hit me up and I'd be happy to tell you about that. But the one relevant part of that is that my interest in sort of communications and content came out of this recognition and sort of discomfort with how poor a lot of highly technically trained individuals, scientists, tend to be when it comes to communicating complex ideas. And so that kind of set me on the path of thinking about how to tell stories, often very technical stories, in a more effective, compelling way. So that's what I do now.
So what is thought leadership? Is it just being an expert and saying things? Or like, how do you think about really what thought leadership is inside the context of your role?
Yeah, so I've read blogs where that is apparently the attitude. But that is not what thought leadership is or should be considered. I view thought leadership as a very clear, focused, again, I'll use the word elevation, of key ideas that can make a difference for a particular audience. So, you know, the joke in the, what was it, early 2000s was that everybody was starting a blog. The joke during quarantine lockdown has been that everybody started a podcast, and that's fine. I love it. I think everybody should try it. It's really fun and you get to play with cool microphones and whatever else, but it's not particularly useful. You've got to have something to say, which sounds obvious, but that's sort of the first thing. If you want to be a thought leader, is you have to have something to say, and you have to be able to say it in a compelling way, which is, just as, if not more important. And so, you know, I think the way to think about it is take a topic that is not particularly interesting to you, and then dig around. You're going to be able to find a blog or a podcast where there is somebody who is so, I want to be careful about using the word passionate, but that's the word, right? So passionate about curling that they can make you care about semi-professional curling in northeastern Minnesota. And if that is thought leadership.
So it's like point of view leadership, basically. Like, I mean, you have to have, to your point, something to say. And then I guess depending on how much people care about your point of view, I guess it's some level of how much leadership you actually have. And so thought leadership is interesting, right? And I think it plays a couple of different roles within an organization, but I'd love your thoughts on why even do it? You know, like what, you know, why do we at Girard even care about thought leadership in the way that we do it now?
It's sort of in very raw transactional terms. Thought leadership is part of content marketing. Content marketing is marketing, which is a form of business development, right? So it sort of all ladders up eventually to contribute to the goals of the organization. So that's, again, that's the transactional part of that. And I don't want to minimize that because obviously that's critically important. Beyond that, though, I see a couple of things. One is that it's really good to get your ideas out into the world to your target audience. And, you know, at the firm, we've got a few different sort of sub audiences, but kind of a core audience within healthcare provider organizations. And you know, a lot of the time, think about this last year, there are very specific critical issues that they're dealing with in the moment. And we have ideas, we have a point of view, as you said, on how they can address those issues. So let's get the good thinking of our firm, of our client advisors, out into the world so people can, one, kind of have a sort of shape their view of the world and how they're seeing these issues, and then also to take action, right? Set the context and then give them some bullet points to actually do something about it. So I think that's the external component. And again, of course, then hopefully that gains some interest and people care and they pick up the phone and they call your business development folks and everybody's happy. The other thing, and if any of our colleagues end up listening to this, you know, here's the dirty little secret from my perspective and what I'm doing when I walk into y'all's office, metaphorically, of course. The other thing that as a content marketer, where I see the value of thought leadership, is that it's a really good way to refine the ideas that people already have. So when I was kind of in my intro, I said, you know, part of what we're trying to do is elevate the voice of the firm. And that means getting the people who have those ideas to put them out in different ways. And what I can do through thought leadership is give folks a different channel to do that and help them, whether they're writing a blog or, you know, doing an internal podcast, internal interview for a podcast, by offering them that platform, it helps them refine those ideas, which they can then use sort of in their, you know, day-to-day work.
And, you know, there's a very mechanical piece to this too, right? Which is like the SEO stuff and the, I guess all kind of leading back to that biz dev side. I mean, you want people as a provider of services, if you will. You know, we want people to find us, we want people to hire us, et cetera. And so obviously this is somewhat of the front end of that. But I think there is a nature of, we've got people that are very passionate about certain topics and have a real point of view and they want to help people. I mean, that's why we're in this line of work anyway. I've said this for a long time, you know, people that work in healthcare, obviously they're there because it's a mission-driven calling. I wouldn't diminish that even for us on kind of the administrative or even marketing side of the equation. We're still working in healthcare for those same reasons. I mean, we could go do this, anywhere, I guess, maybe a little hyperbole, but I mean, you could go do quote unquote marketing for anybody. And the reason we stay and the reason we do this in healthcare and for the providers of healthcare more specifically is because that's where we feel called to do this work. That gives an outlet in a lot of cases for these folks, certainly. But let's switch gears a little bit to, okay, we're doing it. We've decided to do it. How do we do it well? You know, what are some of those best practices, those ideas, things like that? And so maybe it's just a quick rundown just for people listening that maybe aren't familiar with Gerard or haven't been to the website. And what are our delivery mechanisms, or kind of how do we do thought leadership practically, if that makes sense? Maybe kind of run down that list.
Yeah, for sure. And I'll use the names of the specific properties that we have just to sort of make it a little bit more clear. Of course, if anybody wants to check them out, they can. And I'm going to go sort of top to bottom, I guess. So at the top level, sort of roughly categorizing these, we have Art of Change, which is essentially a digital publication, comes out five times. We do sort of in volumes, and within each volume we'll have about five issues. So we're talking about publishing a set of pretty in-depth articles about every other month. So these are long form. You know, we're talking to multiple people across the industry. It is very kind of magazine style. We get into some tactical things, but it's really kind of high level. I mean, it's called The Art of Change, right? So you can imagine just based on that name that it's pretty high level philosophical. You know, how do we think about the world of healthcare and what's going on? The second level that we've got is our blog. We call it High Stakes, and it's our blog. It's pretty traditional. And that's kind of our main feed for most of the work that we do. And we'll do occasionally interviews, things like that. But you're talking about, just for point of reference, you know, sort of your 800 word type of blog post or your 20 minute podcast. And then the other thing that we're doing more and more of, especially through COVID, because attention spans are so short and so much action is needed sort of on any given day, is creating a series of like quick hits. And these are 90-second videos or 3 to 350 word blog posts where we don't waste any time. We just say, here's the scenario and here's what you do about it. And so I go through all of that because I think it's useful to recognize that you can have multiple formats. And if you're going to do this sort of on a full scale, it's probably helpful to do that. But depending on what your objective is, you've got sort of different approaches. Let people think about something big down to, okay, I need help right now. What do I do? Here's three bullet points.
Yeah, I think that's great. And two, everybody's heard all their lives about people learn differently and consume information differently and things like that. So you mentioned, so Art of Change being more kind of the online magazine, if you will, it's, like you said, more in depth, et cetera. Then you've got the blog post, kind of deliverable that everybody's interested in and are used to, I should say. Like, how does podcasting fit in, or the audio piece and the video piece, and kind of how do you think about that, and how do you deploy the written, the audio, and the video kind of together, separate, et cetera?
There are definitely times where one particular format is going to be better for a piece of content. That's fine. There may be something that just makes more sense in a podcast form or a written form. But in general, I'm a big proponent of the create once, publish everywhere. I think there's different versions of it. If you're going to do a bunch of interviews, you might as well push that out to the world in as many different ways as you can. And what you just said, Reed, right? People learn in different ways. They have different attention spans. They consume things in different ways. So you might as well cater to that as much as you can. And what that means in practice is, if I run a series, in fact, I'm doing this right now, I'll run a set of interviews about a particular topic, take pieces of that interview, turn it into a podcast, take that same essentially podcast script, tighten it up so that it's, again, 800 to 1,000 words. And then the other part of it is when I recorded all these interviews, I did it on video. So now I've got these quick little segments where I've got individual people answering a question. And I went into it saying, hey, as you answer these questions, think about it in sort of 60 to 90 second sound bites. So now I've got a whole stack of these little clips that I can post on LinkedIn that cover the same content in very brief snippets. And I've now got multiple platforms. I can publish it across our social media channels. If somebody really wants to sit there in their car or on their run and listen to a 25-minute deep dive, they've got that too. But it runs the spectrum, and the production value is really good, and it reduces the workload of trying to do a bunch of different stuff in different ways, because you're just sort of funneling it, sort of, this creating this waterfall of content, and you're catering to people's preferences.
I historically would have told you that I pretty much only listen to things because I was doing so much of it, like during the commute, right? Drive time, windshield time, whatever. I'm not really commuting anymore, at least not recently or consistently or anything like that. I do still find myself listening to quite a bit, but now I'm kind of back to reading, emails and things like that. And so where does like email fit into all of this and kind of that cadence and deliverable? I mean, is that part of thought leadership? I mean, is it's just a delivery mechanism?
It's not. In sort of thought leadership at large, there's the whole gamut of folks who use it as a delivery system. There are also people who use it as a content channel. And you can make arguments from a number of different angles about that. Again, how people want to consume information, if they just like to sign up for email newsletters. I think from the last I saw, email is still a very effective marketing tool and thought leadership tool to distribute information. I think there's also a bit of FOMO that comes with that too. If you've got really, really good content, then you want to make it exclusive. And the only way to get that material is to sign up for the newsletter. So Gist Healthcare, they've got a weekly, they call it the Weekly Gist. And it's this deep, in-depth, long email that comes out every weekend. And it's funny. It's informative. It's incredibly well-written. The team at Gist is just super smart. And it's a really good piece of content that you can only get via email. It depends on your audience, how you want to do that. And it also depends on your capacity. Email can be thought of both as a delivery mechanism and a channel in its own right.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. And I think a lot of, relatives, like even to marketing and things like that, we talk about personas. And so, I guess a lot of this is like, what kind of content are you delivering and who's it meant for? And then kind of going back and thinking, well, how are they going to consume this ideally? So I know with thought leadership, you're kind of in that industry vertical in most cases, I guess. That may narrow that a little bit. Obviously, you know, we spend a lot of time in LinkedIn. We spend a lot of time on our like our owned properties, right? Blogs and things like that, podcasts, et cetera, but and even email. But it's an interesting place to be, certainly.
Yeah, and like anything in marketing, you got to ask folks, right? You need to figure out who your audience, who your personas are, and then ask them what they want and ask them why they're doing it. You know, do they want to read something so they can learn, or do they want something so they can take some action items to their next meeting with their CEO and look really good in front of everybody? Like those are two different things, and the delivery mechanism and the style is going to be different. So, I mean, it's marketing. You gotta survey your customers.
Folks are listening. Some of them are probably thinking, you know what, we've done some of this because we've had blogs or, you know, whatever in the past. Maybe they have a podcast even. But either they haven't done it, they're trying to revamp it, they want to get started, they really want to, you know, kind of strategically think about, you know, quote unquote thought leadership and doing that in a proactive way. Thoughts, tips there, things people can do today, start working on, that kind of thing?
The first thing I would say is, this is very much my opinion. I don't know if this is a good idea or not, but I think it is. Don't go looking at how many other people are doing thought leadership in your field. I think it's useful to be aware of who's out there and you should always track the competition. But if you're trying to get up off the ground and you're kind of nervous about it, because I think probably everybody is, looking at all the other great material that's out there is not a way to sort of convince yourself to go forward. So
it's probably demoralizing if anything, but yeah, trying to compare yourself to folks that, you know, you haven't done a podcast before and don't really even completely understand, how that makes it into iTunes. And then comparing yourself to This American Life, I guess, for episode one is probably not the greatest idea.
Aspirational for sure. But not useful to sort of, you know, let yourself get sucked into that black hole. So I would say that's step zero. And then it's pretty basic marketing, actually, right? Like you think about, again, who your audience is, who you're trying to reach, what your goals are. Are you trying to influence behavior? Are you trying to inform? Are you trying to entertain? I would suggest that if a good thought leadership platform is going to do all of those things. So kind of figure out, you know, what you're trying to do, and then pick three, maybe four topics within your overall high level umbrella of expertise. And just make those your themes, and then start doing it. Start writing about it. Now, maybe very practically, what I would suggest is once you kind of have an idea of what you want to talk about, set up your phone in front of you. And this gets back to the videos and kind of making short snippets. Set it up in front of you and talk through something that you really care about, or the topic you want to cover for your thought leadership platform. For 90 seconds, have one point that you want to focus on and do it. And now you've got a video, and then just kind of watch that video back and think about how easy it would be to turn that into a blog post and a LinkedIn post and publish the video and send to a client or a prospect and say, hey, here's something that you can do. So I guess that's like start really small and then just go from there. You know, there's all the technical stuff. There's hosting platforms. And if you're podcasting, what gear are you going to get? You can Google that to the end of time and that's all good. But, you know, focus on just like getting rolling and having some fun with it.
Yeah. I tell people all the time, you know, in a lot of what you're talking about, people focus on the wrong thing. You know, they get caught up in what the album cover artwork is going to look like and they haven't recorded anything. Paralysis by analysis is like a thing. And so people get so hung up on trying to figure it all out before they ever get started. Sometimes you just got to start going. Doesn't mean you have to start publishing things for the world to see necessarily, but you've got to start that mechanism to really kind of, I think, get there eventually.
That brings up something I was thinking about earlier, Reed. And that's something that I bump into quite frequently is that a lot of times people, especially really smart people, you know, they want their notes, they want their prep, they want to be really sort of thought out and scripted. And all of that is very good, right? You don't want somebody just shooting off at the mouth for 30 minutes. However, I think a lot of people don't recognize how much they do know about a particular topic and how much they could speak to it extemporaneously. And so getting people comfortable with that, and people may refer to you as the you know, the person, but getting people comfortable with just talking about something they know sort of in the moment is really valuable. And so another thing you can do is record conversations legally and with full consent. But, you know, as you have sort of these water cooler type conversations about whatever topic you may be interested in developing thought leadership around, record it. And then again, you'll quickly see how natural that is and how easily that could be converted into something that people in your audience might want to hear. So that's, you know, another thing to just, you know, to your point, just kind of getting rolling.
Yeah, I like that. This has been great. This has been a great conversation. People that are listening, if they want to connect with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Best option is probably LinkedIn. I'm David Schifrin, S-H-I-F-R-I-N. You can find me there. Please don't send me a connection request that just says I'm expanding my network in Nashville and thought it would be good for us to know each other, because I will ignore you and make fun of you. That's been one of the downsides of work from home, is everybody doing their biz dev on LinkedIn. No, but seriously, yeah, find me on LinkedIn. That's great. And then if you want some examples of what we were talking about, go to gerardinc.com. And you can kind of see how we have our properties set up.
Man, I appreciate it. And we'll, of course, link to that stuff in the show notes as well. But man, appreciate you coming on. And maybe we'll see each other in person again sometime. Who knows? You never know.
It's a long year. We'll see. Thanks, Reed.
Thanks, man. All right. Special thanks to David Schifrin for coming on the show, or as we call him, Schiff. Around the office. We have several Davids. And so anyway, people end up with last names. And anyway, so reach out to him. He's a great guy, very, very thoughtful, and is doing some really, really interesting things. The most recent episode of High Stakes, the podcast out of Gerard that we host here on the network, is really cool, where he actually took several voices and edited that together into one show. Just the editing of it, I thought was really well done. Dr. Brian Vardabedian, host of The Exam Room, also on the network, was one of those guests. And so it's about the uncoupling of the Amazon, Berkshire, JP Morgan, Haven Healthcare, whatever you want to call that thing. So anyway, go check out that episode. It's really good. We've got conferences on the horizon, and so we'll start talking more about those in upcoming weeks. Be sure to check out the Binary Fountain kind of mini webinars that you can find on their website. Go check those out. Lots of great insight there. And let's do some recommendations.
Absolutely. Today, I'm going to recommend an app, Reed, that I just recently discovered. It's called InShot. Have you heard of this app?
I have not.
It's for video and photo production, designed for people using video and photographs from their smartphone. So it's definitely like a video editing and a photo editing app, all in one. Designed for that mobile user. In it, it has the ability to, you can actually get into your videos. You can do very fine-tooth editing to your videos, not only trimming them, but you can go and change the sizes. You can add text overlays, a variety of other things into it. Now, with photos, you have the same ability to kind of create a variety of different overlays, just the standard stuff that you see from like other types of photo editing apps. What I like about it the most is the video capacity of this. You know, not only if you're creating thought leadership content on, let's say, TikTok or other of these visual platforms, Instagram stories, whatever, this would be a great tool to have. But I could see it actually being applied and used in a very professional setting as well. And it's free. So it's called InShot. Definitely encourage you to download it, check it out, and play around with it. Yeah,
nice. That's my recommendation. Very good. I'm going to recommend a docuseries. It is Night Stalker. It's on Netflix, and this is about the serial killer, the Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez. And so anyway, kind of an interesting, I think it's 4 or 5 episodes, something like that. It's just kind of fascinating to see, you know, all the footage from, you know, back when, back in the 80s in LA and that kind of thing. And you hear from those detectives, and I don't know, it's just, I like the Law and Order type documentaries. And so anyway, it's a good one. Pretty interesting. I'm a couple episodes in right now.
You know, I have that. I added that to my queue. So it's good, huh? So I'm going to have to check that out.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating. Really interesting to hear from some of those guys that were there then. So very cool. All right. Well, another episode 207 in the books. Appreciate everybody hanging around. If you would, go tell a friend, go tell a coworker. rate, review, subscribe wherever you happen to be listening. We certainly appreciate that. And visit the website over at touchpoint.health. So for Chris Boyer, I'm Reed Smith, and we'll see you next week. This has been a Touchpoint Media production. To learn more about this show and others like it, please visit us online at touchpoint.health.